So when I was flying back last week from Florida, and I was on the plane, and whenever I'm on the plane, besides trying to sleep, which is never easy for me to do on the plane, the Lord just began to speak to my heart, and it gave me something I wanted to share with you tonight. It's entitled, God and Mr. Miyagi. I figured that most of you grew up and saw Karate Kid at least once. Right? Raise your hand if you saw the original Karate Kid. Okay, it's terrible to talk to an audience that's never seen the Karate Kid. Then the whole message, you just have to flush it. And I have to do, I don't know, something else. But as I meditated on this, the Lord just gave me some tremendous insights, and I wanted to pass them on to you because I found them to be incredibly encouraging in light of Scripture and in light of the story of Mr. Miyagi. Now, for those of you that saw the movie, I'm going to assume that most of you saw the movie. You remember that Daniel was kind of this new kid in town, right? And he's got a single mom, and he's in a difficult situation, and he's never had a father figure in his life. And so he gets in trouble with the local bullies, and they beat him up more than once. And I think it's the second or the third time. I didn't watch the movie to refresh my memory, so forgive me if I'm wrong. Maybe you've seen it 285 times, but I haven't. But somewhere along there, Mr. Miyagi steps in. And he takes on these evil enemies, at least five of them. That's what I read today on Wikipedia. There was five. I refreshed my memory on that most unreliable source, Wikipedia. The rest of the movie I remember. The main part I wanted to share with you tonight. And so Daniel, he's so impressed with what Mr. Miyagi does that he asks him to be his teacher, and Mr. Miyagi refuses, and he refuses, and he refuses. Finally, he says, okay, I'll be your teacher. So he brings Daniel over, and as you recall, Daniel becomes his free slave. And he starts him off, if I remember right, sanding the floors. And he's sanding the floors, and he's sanding the floors, and he's sanding the floors, and he's sweating like crazy, and then he goes to waxing the cars. And he puts the wax on, and he takes the wax off, and he puts the wax on, and he takes the wax off. And then somewhere in there he gets really frustrated. And Mr. Miyagi tells him to knock it off, and he takes him out to the fence, and he has him paint the fence, and paint the fence, and paint the fence, and paint the fence, and on and on and on and on it goes. And all this time, Daniel inside is getting very frustrated. He's getting very angry. He's getting really confused. Like, what in the world are you doing to me? What's the point of all this? I know, I'm just your free slave. You're too old to do your floor. You're too old to wax your car. You're too old to paint the fence. So I'm doing all this for you. And you're not teaching me anything of value. And you're not teaching me any karate at all. So Mr. Miyagi finally, after Daniel gets to this particular breaking point, takes him aside and he starts to do a few things with him. And all of a sudden, Daniel's eyes are opened and he realizes that these simple but very difficult, meaningless, seemingly insignificant, inconsequential, boring, laborious activities provided the muscle memory that he needed for the defensive techniques that Mr. Miyagi was teaching him and Daniel didn't understand. And God is the same way. And I want to talk with you about that tonight. I would like to read a passage from you in Hebrews chapter 12. Have you forgotten how good parents treat their children and that God regards you as a child? My dear child, do not shrug off God's training, but don't be crushed by it either. If the child, it is the child that he loves that he trains, the child he embraces that he corrects. God is educating you. That's why you must never drop out. He's treating you as a dear child. This trouble you're in isn't punishment, it's training. The normal experience of a child. Only irresponsible parents leave children to fend for themselves. Would you prefer an irresponsible God? We respect our own parents for training and not spoiling us, so why not embrace God's training so we can truly live? While we were children, our parents did what seemed best to them, but God is doing what is best for you, training us to live God's holy best. At the time, training and discipline isn't fun. It always feels like it's going against the grain, but later, of course, it pays off handsomely, for it's the well-trained child who find themselves mature in their relationship with God and useful to the master. Sometimes you and I look at our lives, and this has happened to me many times, and I know many of you here tonight are going through this kind of situation. I'm sharing this tonight because you rockers are really, really important to me. I really love you, and I really care about you. More than you know, I carry you in my heart. No matter where I go, if I'm in Berlin, if I'm in Florida, if I'm in Honduras, wherever I go in the country, I always carry you very close to my heart, and I pray for you. And my greatest desire is to see your lives be the success that God intended and to see your lives count for eternity. That's my greatest desire. And as I was pondering this and asking God, Lord, I just pray that you would speak to me. You know, one of the things I do often is just ask God to use me to bless your life. Lord, somehow speak to me so that I can speak to them. Show me what would be timely and needed and beneficial to their life at this moment. And God gave me this message. It is so incredibly important that you understand that every single thing God is bringing into your life right now, that God has brought into your life, and that God is going to bring into your life, is not meaningless and insignificant and pointless and inconsequential, even though at the time it can seem, Lord, what's the point? Sometimes it can almost feel like God is that terrible military sergeant that's having you dig a hole all day long, pile the dirt up, it's 6 feet deep, and then he has you climb up at the top and put the dirt all back in the hole. And you're wondering, what am I doing here, and what is going on? And why is God doing this to me? And tonight what I hope to do is to be able to enlighten you and encourage you and inspire you with what God is doing so that you understand what's going on. There's a passage that I'd like to share with you out of Psalm 78. But before I do, I'd like to read this to you. God has a custom-made training program designed just for you. He took into consideration all the necessary factors of your personality, your temperament, your unique gifts, and your weaknesses, and your future, and what he wants to do with your life. He designed the circumstances of life to bring about the training needed for your greatest usefulness for his service. He knows what he wants you to become and the plans that he has for you to fulfill your real destiny. He is preparing you for the next thing. God has custom designed a program for you. You know, you can go out and you can get a personal trainer. And for a lot of people, a personal trainer is very helpful. Some of you, maybe you've seen the show. I haven't. You know, I hear commercials. I hear little bits about it, The Biggest Loser. So you've got these severely, severely overweight people, very obese individuals. Some of them, their life's going to end if they don't do something different. What happens is, there's usually a guy trainer, I know that, and a girl trainer. And every time, this is the background, you don't always see this on TV, is those individuals get to know their subjects in a very personal way. Often they'll show you on the show the background story, the family, their environment. And they take into consideration what their capabilities are, and they push them just a little farther, and then just a little farther, and then with each week they get on the scale, and you see who the biggest loser is, and then at the end of the series, they unveil this new person. All because someone designed a program personally for that individual. Now, of course, the secret was not just the program. The secret was the cooperation of the subject. For without the cooperation of the subject, the program is meaningless. If Daniel decided, Mr. Miyagi, I've had it with you, wax on and you wax off, and he left, then there would have been no glorious moment. You liked that, didn't you? I could actually do that on that stump right there if there wasn't a cross right there. But I won't tonight. The end of the movie is only because Daniel cooperated in trust with the one who was demonstrating to him that he cared. God is far greater than Mr. Miyagi. For God takes into consideration your makeup, your internal constitution, your heart, your background, all the factors of your life. Your personality, whether you're choleric, sanguine, melancholy, or phlegmatic, or a combination of any of the two or three. God takes into consideration your abilities and your strengths and your weaknesses and all these things, and He puts them in His supernatural blender. And He brings out custom-made circumstances for your life. I'm going to share with you one biblical example, and then I'm just going to walk you through very briefly some of those kinds of circumstances in my life. And some of the great lessons and reasons why I had to go through them. In Psalm 78, verse 70, we find this phrase. God chose His servant David, calling him from the sheep pens. He took David from tending the ewes and the lambs, and He made him the shepherd of Jacob's descendants, God's own people Israel. He cared for them with a true heart and led them with skillful hands. And then I'm going to go over here and read before I comment on it in Samuel. This is in 1 Samuel chapter 17. And David has gone out to see how the battle is going with his brothers and the Israelites. Huge battle. Think Gladiator at the beginning of the movie when Russell Crowe's riding back on the horse with his wolf dog beside him. And they're getting ready as he tells his general, co-general, we're going to unleash hell on Germania. And David had, in response to his father said, I want you to go to the battle lines and see how your brothers are doing. David was the baby of the family. David was the runt of the family. David's big job was taking care of the sheep. It was not a noble job. It was not a job that any Jewish boy in this time was proud of. His brothers, they were out there on the front lines. And David was taking care of sheep. Lots of sheep. A lot of time alone. Out by himself. And actually, some pretty freaky things happen. And he refers to those in this moment. King Saul is looking for someone who will fight this giant. There is this giant that keeps defying the nation of Israel. He's so frightening that all the men cower in his presence. His name was Goliath. David's brothers wouldn't challenge him. No one would challenge him. So David said, don't worry. I'll go fight the Philistine. Saul says, don't be ridiculous. You're an idiot. There's no way you can go against this Philistine. You're a boy, and he's been in the army since he was a boy. Now, I want you to notice for a moment that Saul himself refers to David as a boy. I mean, it's no wonder his brothers were a little indignant. This was a boy. David certainly probably was not even 16 years old. He was viewed by Saul as a boy. So I want you to notice what David says. David persisted. I have been taking care of my father's sheep. Well, great. So what? That really qualifies you. I've been taking care of my dad's sheep. When a lion or a bear comes to steal a lamb from the flock, I run away from it. No, he said, I go after it with a club and I take the lamb from its mouth. If the animal turns on me, I scream. No, I catch it by the jaw and I club it to death. I've done this to both lions and bears. And I'll do it to this pagan Philistine too, for he's defied the armies of the living God. The Lord who saved me from the claws of the lion and the bear will save me from the Philistines. Now what does this tell us? What extraordinary revelation do we find out in these three little tiny verses of the story of this man who was a boy? We find it was nothing wasted with God. We find that in Psalm 78, God had him with the sheep. God was using those dumb animals to train David to be the king of the nation of Israel. We would have never thought of such a thing. Hey, I'm going to send you to king school. Go take care of 1,000 sheep. I'm going to teach you how to lead a nation. Mr. President, go take care of the chickens. No, we go to Harvard, we go to Yale, or somewhere else. You get politically connected. But you don't take care of lambs. Then I want you to notice that David, it's pretty obvious, David took his job and faithfulness very seriously. Here's why. Look, if a lion's coming at me or a bear's coming at me and I'm only protecting a few sheep, I know that the lion or bear is only going to take one. Better a sheep than my leg or my arm. That's what's going to go through our mind. Take the sheep. Bye. Leave. You can only eat one at a time anyway. What am I going to risk my life for? A sheep. That shows the heart of the man, doesn't it? I mean, David had such a tender heart. What does it say? It says in Psalm 78, he had a tender heart and skillful hands. Where did he get a tender heart and skillful hands? From the custom design program of God on the backside of a mountain, away from everybody, watching sheep. Watching sheep. When it was cold, when it was hot, when he was lonely, David's watching sheep. He goes after the lion. He goes after the bear. Not only did he rescue the animal from their mouths, but if they turned on him, he didn't stop there. He dropped the animal, grabbed them by their jaw, and he beat them to death. Now, when he says lion or bear, he wasn't talking about squirrel-sized bear. You know why? You know why? Because if it was a squirrel, he wouldn't have the confidence to go against a man who's 9 foot tall, whose spear, the head of it alone, weighs 15 pounds. You see, David had already killed his giants in private, just nobody there to see. But God knew. God knew. And God was preparing David for a moment that David did not even know would come. It wasn't like God said, okay, David, let's sit down and talk. Now listen, 2 years from today, man, you are going to be grand champion of the entire nation. Really, God? How's that? Well, here's what's going to happen. It's going to be this big battle. It's going to be this big giant. God didn't do that. God found out David was faithful by not telling him a thing. You see, that's how God trains us. He doesn't tell us anything. We walk by faith, see. David was out there, and God mattered to David. And doing his job well mattered to David. And dealing with the loneliness and the cold, he just trusted God for it. He knew God was doing something, but he didn't know what. Never, ever forget that the things that seem inconsequential to you or mundane or boring or meaningless or insignificant or stupid or foolish tasks, they always, all of them, have a great purpose with God. They have a great purpose with God. And I thought it would be helpful if I went through with you some of the things as I look back on my life. I took some time to do this today, and I will try to be brief. I will be brief. Of some of the things the Lord did in my life that at the time, every single one of them was very, very difficult. And so many of them were confusing at the time. They didn't make a lot of sense at the time, but I'm just being honest with you. I held on to these passages in Hebrews chapter 12, in Psalm 78, and the story of David, and of course many other stories. Joseph's story, Esther's story, Nehemiah's story, and others that I could go into. But I held on to them, not knowing exactly all they would mean in my own life, but I just held on that God knows what he's doing with my life, even when I'm scared to death, even when it just seems like this is all crazy. I remember one of the first big things the Lord took me through was what I would call difficult relatives. Now, I'm not going to get into all the story because some of you heard the story, but my entrance into following Christ was almost a baptism by fire. It was not yet 2 full years when I began to follow Christ that I had the most horrific things begin to happen, and I could not understand them. I had never encountered this kind of hatred. I'd never encountered this kind of vilification. I'd never encountered this kind of presumptions being made about my life. And all this that I thought God was doing between Kathy and I, this beautiful thing, was shattered by the extraordinary hatred that was coming from relatives. And it was, I'm not exaggerating when I say it was really, 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 really awful. Awful stuff. Awful things being said about me. Awful things being spread to other relatives about me, about us. And the eventuality of her parents not even coming to our wedding. And then the stuff that happened early on in our marriage. It just continued. It just continued. But I want to share something with you. It was very, very important that it happened to me. Dealing with difficult relatives taught me not to return evil for evil. The Bible says, let him who wants to enjoy life and see good days refrain his tongue from evil, his lips from speaking deceit. Let him seek peace and pursue it. Let him do good and not evil. Do not return evil for evil, but give a blessing instead. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil by doing good. Some 22 years later, after our wedding, after all the vilification, God began to do a work in my wife's father. And one day, he said to my wife, when they were alone and this terrible event happened in his life, he said, Kathy, the greatest lesson I ever learned in my life, I learned from you and Mark, and I'm going to do this towards this other person. And she looked at him and said, what are you talking about? He said, the lesson of forgiveness. I cannot believe this is the first time in 22 years anything's ever been said about these things that had happened. We never, ever brought them up to her parents. We never threw them in their face. We never held it against them. The second great lesson God taught me was how to forgive injustices. Now, I'm not perfectly learned it. Now, I'm still learning it. But this was the first big one. And for him to say, you forgave us, you didn't disrespect us, and I'm going to do that, it was a life-altering experience for my wife when she heard those words come from his mouth. And that was 22 years after the fact. Will you wait 22 years? Will you return a blessing for evil? Will you forgive the injustices that are done to you by those who said they loved you? If not, I'm going to share something with you before I say this. There's only one thing in life that matters to me. This is the simplest and clearest way I can say this to you. There is only one thing in my life that matters to me. Don't ever forget I said this. And that is to be useful to God. I have no other desire, no other wish, no other want. I want God to use me. I want to be useful to God and then die. And if I can't be useful to God, then I just want to die. That's all that's mattered to me. For 35 years, and for the rest of my life, that's all that matters to me, to be useful to God in the lives of others. If you do not return evil for a blessing for evil, if you do not learn to forgive injustice, if you do not cooperate with God, you will never be useful to God. God taught me. God began to teach me. And all these things in this first big, massive, unbelievable, painful trial. When Kathy and I were 21 years of age, it was as if a tsunami hit our life. God began to teach me meekness and humility by being mistreated, maligned, misunderstood, and humiliated. Do you understand that pride is the most destructive thing in your life? And do you not understand that the only way that God breaks our pride is to take you through humiliating circumstances? Sometimes to me, all of you are like my kids, but watching Jeremy up here singing, or Micah, or seeing my kids from time to time doing the music, I sit back and sometimes I'm in awe and sometimes I'm jealous. But let me explain what I mean by that. They get these incredible sound tech guys, TJ and Doug and Ian, and all the sound system and all this stuff. I used to have to stand on a campus and sing, and I have recordings at home that I burn. The most humiliating moments of my life. Standing out with a band that couldn't play, and the sound would feed back in our ears, and often the concert was delayed 35 minutes in utter humiliation. And I would go out, the guys would know we need to do it again, and know we need to do it again, and we do it again. I mean, I had never felt so humiliated in my life. Was it worth it? Let me tell you this, honestly. Just about anything's worth it to get rid of pride. And I'd be the first to admit, I was a very, very proud young man. And God knows how to get at pride. Because He knew that greater than my pride was my desire, I want to be used by God. I want to be used by God, and God only gives grace to the humble. God opposes the proud. He doesn't hate you. He loves you. But in His love, He will not exalt your talent or your gifts without a heart of humility. And He will put His hand on your head like a little boy trying to hit you and just hold you there till you break. Till you break. Second big situation the Lord used in my life was my wife and I cooking in a sorority. That was our job. Kathy was expecting our first child, Celeste, and we moved into the Alpha Chi Omega house at Iowa State University. In all the history of Iowa State, we're the only family couple that ever lived in the basement of a sorority as cooks. God taught me how to keep going when all of our meals were criticized. Criticism isn't easy to deal with. Hasn't been easy as a pastor. God knew what I was going to have to endure as a pastor. I didn't, and I'm really glad He didn't tell me, because if He had, I would have quit. As a young man, I just would have quit. I won't now, but I would have then. You ought to try to please 50 women with one meal. It's really difficult to do. And so my wife and I, we learned some pretty amazing lessons, but one of them was to deal with criticism. Now I got to tell you, to a guy, I know this is going to sound really weird, but remember, I'm still a very young man. I'm like, now I'm 23. And women's opinion really matters. And we got these 50 girls. I want them to like our food. We were working really hard. The reason they hired us is because the last chef they had went over their budget $20,000. Now, sorority, that's a big deal because the deal is none of the girls can go home for the summer until they work enough to pay off the $20,000 over budget. So they made it really clear to us they didn't want to be over budget. So we had a $32,000 food budget to work with that year. We fed them lunch and dinner. That was our job. Breakfast they did on their own. They had little waiters. They'd ring a little bell and the waiters would come out and wait on them. And my wife and I, she figured out, she's very organized. She figured out, look, Mark, if we have the same meal 4 times a year, we can have this rotating menu. We can go for these 2 months here and 2 months, then 2 months. She had it all figured out. And then we'll order the stuff. So we ordered the stuff. I knew the context because I used to work at this Ramada Inn. But what you don't understand is there was a board in the hall, a big board, where the girls wrote their comments every day. Hate the peas. The fish was terrible. I love the fish. I love peas. More peas. Your chicken sucked. I liked your chicken. And you're back and you're forth and you're back and you're forth. And I began to realize as a young man, you can't please everybody. You just got to do the best you can and let the chips fall where they may. The most important thing is it's good, it's warm, it's nutritious, and we are not over budget the last day of May. Keep your eye on the prize, Mark. So Kathy handled the baking, and I handled the cooking. And we're talking one of those gigantic mixers, big Hobarts, we'd be making the mashed potatoes. I'll never forget our first big deal. It was rush week, right? Rush week is when they rush all the girls through. Literally, they rush them through, trying to handpick which girls recruit they might want to move into the house. So Kathy decided, Mark, let's make homemade banana muffins. Now, you ever notice with girls, they won't eat cake, but boy, will they eat muffins. They have chocolate muffin, strawberry muffin, cream cheese muffin. As long as you call it a muffin, they'll eat it. Yeah, I know a lot more about girls than you'd imagine. I live with 50 of them. Okay, I didn't live with them, but I lived in the basement in a hole with my wife and my woman and my baby woman. So I was the only guy in the house. So she decides, let's make homemade banana muffins. So we get all the bananas, and we're making the muffins. And Kathy's working. She's the baker, and she's incredible at it. And it called for baking something. What was it, Kathy? Baking powder? Yeah, I think that was it. I figured baking soda was the same thing. Baking powder, baking soda, P.S., what's the difference? So I grab it. We dump in the amount. It's quite a bit. This beautiful aroma is filling the room. And I thought, you know, the wise chef always tastes what you're going to serve to people before you serve it. So I take a big bite of this golden brown banana muffin, and I start spewing it everywhere out of my mouth. Kathy says, what's wrong? I said, I don't know. They taste horrible. And, of course, you know who got the blame. What did you give me? I said, well, I don't know. What does it say? It's supposed to be baking powder, not baking soda. And I'm like, oh, geez. 15 minutes before rush, right? She says, Mark, you got to get in the car. Drive to Hy-Vee, shop Hy-Vee, where there's a helpful smile in every aisle. And I go driving to Hy-Vee, buying 150 banana muffins. Yeah. Well, I learned a valuable lesson. I was humbled again. I learned to take criticism. I learned I couldn't please everybody. It taught me how to faithfully oversee a large amount of money. We've been overseeing money here. I help oversee our $3.5 million evergreen budget that's all of our churches. I'm a part of it, but I help oversee it. And you saw the video recently. We've had our independent audits 2 or 3 years in a row, and the guys told us you're one of the best run organizations I've ever seen. I can't believe how your ducks are in a row. Now we got a team of people. But for me personally, I learned some of these lessons very, very, very young. I didn't know exactly how they'd all be used. I just knew it was important to God that I was faithful, that He was training me for something. Another huge lesson I learned was how to work with my wife. Man, you try being in a kitchen together. She got the new baby sitting on the counter. We're working together and we're trying to bake the food. And she's got her ideas and I got my ideas. And we had to learn to work together and oversee these couple little waiters that waited on all the guys. And we led them to Christ. Both the waiters. My next big training lesson was selling auto parts. I got the job after being out of work 3 months and going through the phone book and calling all these different places. I started in the A's and now I was in the S's. And when I got to the S's, the guy said, "We just let the person go. Come on down and see us." I had to drive in a blizzard to go do this interview. The guy didn't give me much of his time. He called me a few days later and told me, "You got the job, but you got to have your own car." I didn't have a car. This was on a Friday. I had to start on a Monday. So I didn't tell him I didn't have a car because he didn't ask. He just told me, "You got to have a car." I said, "Okay." I had no money to get a car, no relatives to get a car from, no credit to get a car. I mean, they were really, really, really bad. I'll get to some of that in a minute. And long, long story short, God miraculously provided a car late Sunday night at about 10 o'clock. A woman called me on the phone and said, "I heard you need a car." I said, "I'm not sure how you heard I needed a car, but what's the situation?" She said, "My car is just in my garage. My mechanic told me how to drive it. I only take it out once or twice a year. It's not an antique or nothing like that. It's just that I work across the street from the university, so I never drive it. Would you drive it? Would you use it?" I said, "Let me explain what I'm going to be doing with it." Great. After I explained, that's just what I want. I learned a lesson of faith, a tremendous lesson of faith. I don't know too many people have a story like that. It was a great lesson of faith for a young man trying to take care of a family. So I start this job. I find out a month into it that the guy lied to me. It's straight commission. It's straight commission. There is no hourly pay. There is no monthly paycheck. There is whatever I sell. And then I find out he's lied to me. The store is doing half the business he said it was doing. Now, I know a little bit about cars. I know where tires are, battery is, a muffler is, and spark plugs are. I know where a door is. I know where a window is. You know, basic things about a car, but there was a lot of things about selling auto parts I didn't know. You know what it taught me? It taught me to take initiative. It taught me to be bold. It taught me tenacious persistence as I tried to go out and find new business. And you know what was really tough about the situation? Is there was five other auto parts stores in this same town of 40,000 people. We were the only store that delivered with one delivery truck. Everybody else had three delivery trucks per store. They could get overnight service. I couldn't. And two of the stores had their girls deliver in bikinis from spring through summer. It was a really, really, really tough environment. And on top of that, the guy who used to have my job had a terrible reputation. And when I walked into at least half the stores, half the garages, they found out who I was from. They pointed the door and say, "Get the blank out of here. I don't want to do business with your company." Now I got to tell you, every time I turn around, I'm like, baptism by fire, baptism by fire. I'm kind of done with this, Lord. Been there, done that. Can we stop? Can I get a break? Okay, just before I took this job, right? One of the guys who's the waiter at the sorority, we led him to Christ. The guy is a ditz. I'm sorry if you're out there and you hear this. I love you. The guy read comic books all the time. The guy, I won't go on anymore. He gets a job for $27,000 a year, working 9 months out of the year, driving around on a little cart at Vietnam Golf Course. "I used to do landscaping. Why can't I get a job like that, Lord?" No, I've got to be stuck at this pathetic auto parts store, getting lied to, getting kicked out of places. "You don't know what you're doing, Mr. Miyagi." "Oh, yes, I do, Mark." You know what kind of courage you're going to have to say the things I want you to say to thousands of people in a room? If you can't walk in to a garage and introduce yourself and take a little blow and has some guts and shows some initiative, how in the world am I going to trust you to say the things that I'm going to have you say? God knew. I didn't understand it all. But I knew that I wanted to bring God glory and I wanted to be faithful with what He gave me to do. God taught me how to pray and believe God for the impossible. That whole first year, I decided, see, I was on straight commission. So you'd make so many calls a day. What a lot of the salesmen would do is they'd go play golf every afternoon. And I decided I'm going to go pray. So every afternoon, I went to pray for an hour. The back of this park, back in the city, in the back of this stone shelter. And I would walk and I would pray. I'd pray for my family. I'd pray over my life. I'd pray my walk with God and I prayed for the business. And I asked God to double it. I said, God, I want you to double it. Please double this business. Lead me to customers by the end of the year. The business had doubled in sales. You don't learn about faith from a book. You learn about faith by getting out of the classroom and into the arena. And God knows that. And it's as scary as heck. And it was a lot of pressure. Because it wasn't just me. So a single guy like me, listen, I can live in a garage. I've lived in a garage before. I can live in a garage on a 10-cent cot. I lived on a 10-cent cot that I bought from the Goodwill in a sleeping bag I paid a dollar for that I never had to do laundry with. I just crawled into it, slept. But when you got a wife and you got kids depending on you and you're on straight commission and you don't know much about auto parts and you're getting kicked out of stores and you want to die and crawl in a hole, let me tell you, God builds your faith or you die. You walk away. You just give up. God knows what He's doing with your life. My next big deal was working two jobs at 75 hours a week. Came to about 75 hours a week. And God taught me how to trust God for supernatural grace and power when I didn't think I could get out of bed. When I come home from one job at 5, have to be the next one at 6, 4 nights a week, and then get home till 1 in the morning. And I'm like, how am I going to do this, Lord? How am I going to do this? My strength feels gone. I don't want to do this. My wife is home, weak from our third baby. She's got a terrible back. Am I abandoning her? How am I going to do all this, Lord? How am I going to do this? And God taught me that when He says, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me, that He really meant it. And the only way I could discover it is to get into a situation that I thought would just plow me over. And I had to put one foot in front of the other and hang on for dear life. And I started to learn, wow, oh, wow, wow. Okay, well, oh, there's grace here. There's grace. When I stepped out, there's grace. I was still tired. I still wondered days how I would do it. God taught me to live by the right priorities. Why? I didn't have much time. If I didn't prioritize God and my family, I would have lost both. I couldn't use the fact that I was working 75 hours a week. If God, I want to be useful to you, then I had to maintain my priorities. I had to maintain my prayer life. I had to maintain my time with the Lord and to maintain my relationship with my wife. And I had to maintain whatever relationship I could with my children. And God taught me to listen in greater ways to truth and transform my life. It was during that period of my life that I learned how to buy up every moment. And instead of listening to my radio in the car, I bought a little Walkman and I listened to 7 tapes. I averaged 14 hours a week on those tapes for a solid year. I made a little pouch that I carried around at the video arcade at night. And then I drove around and I bought rechargeable batteries when they first came out. And I listened over and over and over because I was believing that God says you could be transformed by the renewing of your mind. This was not a game. I knew this was not a game. I knew God was building me for something more, and I was going to cooperate with God. And the last thing I'm going to share with you tonight was living in our $1,000 trailer and being very poor. And I'm not exaggerating. When I sold the trailer, I got $600 for it. I've never exaggerated to you when I said this trailer was a ghetto trailer. This trailer was 10 feet by 52 feet. 520 square feet for five people. None of the windows would open in this trailer because all the cranks were broken. In the summer, it was a little oven. It would get to about 105 degrees in the trailer. And God taught me some amazing lessons. One of the first was how to be content with a little and learn to do without. Man, God taught Kathy and I and the kids so many marvelous things. I'll never forget, we were there first week, the water heater broke. I'm thinking, Mr. Fix-It, I'm pretty good at fixing things. Most people don't know that. I don't tell people that because I really don't enjoy it. But if I have to do something, I'll try to do it. So I'm like, well, I can fix this water heater. It's just the thermostat on the side. You just got to screw it out. It's electrical and put a new one in. Problem was it was rusted completely. The thing was so old, it was rusted. Well, I didn't have money to get a water heater. So here we are, two little children, a new one on the way. She came shortly after, Jessica. And so we played Little House in the Prairie in the sink. We heat up the warm water on the stove, stand the little kids in the sink, turn on the cold, mix it, get it just right temperature, and give them a bath in the sink. And we go down and borrow the neighbors. Or go to the university and sneak into the gym showers. Whatever we had to do. God taught us and taught me how to be frugal and wise with our money. One of the most important lessons I learned as I headed into ministry, one of the ways we've been able to make our money go so far is God taught me how to be wise and frugal with what we had. God really tested me. I'll tell you one of the ways he tested me. I'm going to get into this maybe in some weeks to come. But let me tell you what integrity, one way, not the only way, but one way that integrity looks. I'm working this extra job and we're paying off a couple debts and we're barely getting by. But once in a while we have a little extra money. So you always have this choice. With the extra money, do we go spend it on us? Or do I give it to God? Because you see, we were so broke, I didn't have money to tithe. So the question is, will I tithe to God first, or will I use His money on me? And it's real easy. Let me tell you, I've been there. When you're thinking, oh, I haven't taken my family to McDonald's. We don't ever get to go there. We don't ever get to go there. You know what, God? You didn't hold up your end of the bargain. Sorry. I'm using the extra 40 bucks for us. Didn't do it. Didn't do it. My wife and I made a commitment. We made a commitment. As soon as we found out about the whole area of tithing, we were driving home one night from that meeting and we were discussing it together. She says, Mark, did God speak to you? I said, well, I think he did. Did he speak to you? She said, he did. I said, well, what did he say to you? She said to me, Mark, we need to tithe. I said, okay, Kathy, that'll be about $120 a month. I said, here's what that means. It means I will have to work these hours two more years to divert 120 from the extra bills we're paying so that we can tithe. And a friend had just sold me a car for $500 and I was paying him $100 a month. She looked at me, she said, Mark, I'd rather have a husband who's working two extra years long than to rob God. That's why I married that woman. And so that next week, I wrote out our first $120 check in faithfulness to God. 4 days later, my phone rings. The guy who sold me the car said, Mark, I don't know how to explain this, but last night, I couldn't get you off my mind. I couldn't get the car off my mind. And God just told me, Bob, call him and just tell him the rest of the debt's canceled. And God says in Malachi, test me now in this and see if I will not open the storehouse of heaven for you and pour out from heaven. 4 months after that, I got a call. Never happened before in the church in Ames. This was the first time. They called and said, Mark, we know you're working nights at that video arcade. We'd like you to come work for us. And whatever you're making there, we'll pay you to do our music and lead one of our house churches. Will you pray about it? And I said, no. They said, what do you mean you won't pray about it? I said, I've been praying about it for years. The answer is yes. When do you want me to start? I'm ready. God keeps His word. Will you cooperate with God? God taught me not to worry about what others think. And I mean, we're living up in a trailer court that was the ghetto trailer court of Ames. Most of the traders had boards up on the window. My wife, it didn't matter what family thought. It didn't matter if others thought, oh, geez, you know, you live up in that trailer. It didn't matter to us. You know what we saw it as? And I'm going to get to this. We saw it as a tremendous mission field. There were so many poor people up there, so many needy people up there. And we just determined, God, you put us here. Use us for the gospel. And some of our most cherished memories of stories leading people to Christ were in that trailer court. God taught us how to reach out to others and be a light to the whole court. God taught me more lowliness and humility. Now, I'll be the first one to admit there's still many of these lessons. He's going to another level. And someday I'll share with you some of the things he's taught me the last 6 years with my daughter's illness and things I thought really would truly kill me. But that's for another day. What I wanted you to understand tonight is that no matter who you are or where you're at in your life, God has a custom-made program for you. You want him to use you. If you've been asking God to use you, if you've been asking God to use you, he's going to train you. He's going to work with you. You're his much-loved child. And he's going to correct and guide and mold and build so that he can use you in greater and greater ways. God is your Mr. Miyagi. And he knows exactly what he's doing with your situation. Father, we just thank you tonight for the tremendous treasure that we have in Jesus Christ, for the tremendous treasure that we have in the knowledge that you know what is best for us, even when it seems insane. My goodness, Lord, you know I've squealed like a stuck pig more than hundreds of times. Like, Lord, what are you doing? And you sure you know what you're doing? And sure don't seem like you know what you're doing. But as I look back, Lord, on my life, and even going over some of these stories, I see how you worked on the inside of me, how you worked on the outside of me, how you were trying to shape me and mold me and break me down and build me up and then break me down some more and prune me and get me ready for so many of the things you have me doing today. And yet, at the same time I'm doing them, you're getting me ready for other things by pruning me, molding me, humbling me, causing pain and difficulty in my life. Father, I just pray that every young person here tonight would walk away with a confidence and a settled peace and maybe even joy that you are as Mr. Miyagi to them. And they are going to see you do great things in and through their life as they cooperate with you. You're the greatest trainer there's ever been. You never make mistakes. In Jesus' name, amen.